Right. Usually, attorneys work 15 minutes for primary argument. There is a timing mechanism displayed on the screen. Please be mindful of the time. We'll hear first from counsel for appellant. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. Gregory Seaman appearing on behalf and with Miss Marie Schroeder, who's seated in gallery this morning.
You may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, this matter comes before the court on a request and an appeal of the order of the court dated January 12, 2023 in Benton County, Minnesota. The Honorable Judge Jesse presiding over that matter. This was a virtual hearing matter in which the parties were called upon with respondent bringing a motion to modify parenting time and to change the schooling of the minor children of the parties. The appeal or the original proceeding stems from a judgment and decree of divorce that was issued between the parties in May of 2019. That agreement was, or that judgment was by agreement, by stipulation of the parties, that the parties would share joint physical and joint legal custody of the two minor children of the parties, Weston and Grayson. But the judgment also indicated mom was to serve as the primary residence for the children, which included mom placing the children for schooling near her residence. And that was by, again, stipulation of parties.
Counsel, as I understand it, we're here today because the district court issued a default order changing the primary residence. And there are some concerns raised about the procedure and whether or not mother had noticed. Could you address those procedural aspects of the case rather than the historical facts?
Okay. There are two prongs to the argument as to why the default judgment should be reversed and remanded back. The first issues have to do with the procedural issues that you're referring to. A couple of them are pretty significant, the other one fairly minor. That would be the first one of improper service of the motion. The Minnesota General Rules of the Court 3355.02 clearly indicates that you cannot serve a pro se party using electronic mail. This was not an e-filing service. This was simply an email to our client with the documents supposedly attached, indicating the time of the hearing and so forth.
Counsel, while we understand that, doesn't the record also show that your client had actual notice of the hearing?
Yes, and that's why I think this is the lesser of the three points or problems with the procedures in the case. Yes, she did have what I refer to as constructive notice. She knew that the hearing was going to take place. But that leads us to the other procedural issues, which are really problematic in my mind. The first one is that the motions had a handwritten time for the hearing appearing in the face of the motion. That handwritten statement, which apparently was supposed to be for 10:15 a.m., the date of the hearing, my client, I believe, reasonably and understandably, actually read as being 10:45 instead of 10:15.
And she brought that to the court's attention?
She did. Within 15 minutes of the original time of 10:15, she contacted the clerk asking, what do I do now? The hearing's coming up at 10:45. What do you need me to do? Only to find out that the hearing had already taken place at 10:15.
And this was a Zoom hearing. So when she contacted the court, she logged on to Zoom for the hearing.
Yes, that's correct. And she was told, oh, the hearing's already taken place. The order will issue from the hearing.
So then she contacted you at some point?
She contacted my colleague, Mr. Dietrich, who's seated at the council table today. And he immediately contacted the court regarding the error.
How long after the hearing was that contact?
I believe it was within the next 24 hours. A letter was sent to the court indicating the error in the timing, that the client had in fact appeared, but late, due to the handwritten timing on the motion papers.
Request for a hearing was made on that
That is correct.
Well, let me ask this. You sent the letter was sent.
Yes.
Did the letter say we move the court to vacate and set the matter for a hearing?
I believe the letters indicated two possible options for the court. One was to reopen the file and have a new hearing where counsel could appear with his client, or to simply set the matter on for an evidentiary hearing based on an assumption that the prima facie affidavit reading would support the order, if in fact that's what the court chose to do.
And did you give notice to Father's counsel of your request?
Yes, the letter was copied to counsel. She was aware of it, and she actually made a written response to that request to the court a few days later, which led to a secondary letter from Mr. Dietrich indicating the same argument basically again and reciting case law and other.
What is your best legal support for your implied assertion that the district court should have given you a hearing at that point?
Well, our position was the client understandably and reasonably failed to make the appearance due to the poorly handwritten time that appeared on the motion papers.
So is it a Rule 60 motion to vacate, or is it under Chapter 518?
Well, the motion to vacate was actually a motion to rehear the matter. It wasn't a motion to vacate as such. It was a motion, it was a letter request to the court asking for rehearing is what it was.
And normally, in an instance like this, would the motion be made under Rule 60 civil procedures, or isn't there something within the family law statutes that's an alternative for obtaining relief from an order in a family law case?
It's my understanding, and again, I believe it's Rule 60, but I'm going to say today, it's my understanding from past experience with asking for rehearing, is you have to get permission from the district court judge to rehear the matter and then
so
file.
So you were asking for you were making a motion for reconsideration, not a motion to vacate.
That's correct.
Did you formally make a motion to vacate?
There was no formal motion. The court issued a brief statement saying it would not entertain a new motion for reconsideration.
And if there was no motion, then aren't these arguments forfeit?
We don't believe they are forfeit, because if the court is directing that it would not consider the motion, we are left with no alternative but to come to the Court of Appeals.
What about the motion to reopen the proceeding under Rule 115.11?
I'm not familiar with 115.11, I'm sorry.
The problem may be that the two different things, to go to the court and say move to vacate the order under Rule 60, there's a set of factors that the court has to apply in determining whether or not to grant the motion, and then we review application of those factors and the decision, I believe, for an abuse of discretion. Whereas to simply say we'd like the judge to reconsider, I don't think there is any authority, you know, that allows judges to reconsider. It happens and people do it, and sometimes judges do, but they're two different things. So I think what the point my esteemed colleague is making is you didn't ask for the relief that would trigger the analysis by which the judge would have to look at what he or she has done and decide whether maybe, yep, we should start order forward. I think those factors are once the order was known to the person who's challenging it, they promptly contacted the court, sought relief, they have a defense on the merits, those sorts of things. Whereas a motion to reconsider is just, will you reconsider this? And the judge simply say, no, I'm not aware of any case law or rule that governs the judge's decision-making in that instance.
Well, a review of the letters are actually in the court file and were attached as attachments to our brief, clearly indicate the legal basis for why the reconsideration was being made and why it would be proper to set the matter on for evidentiary hearing. Even if the court should decide to move forward under the default order, it still had an obligation to justice and fairness to basically set up an evidentiary hearing. And that has to do with the legal and discretionary act of the court in this matter.
And was an evidentiary hearing mandated if the judge makes a preliminary finding that the endangerment standard is met?
In this case, he did not make that finding that the endangerment statute had been met. He only made a cursory statement in regard to change of circumstances, which is not the standard. And that's what we're arguing here today, that even if the reconsideration doesn't take place based on the procedural flaws, The legal and discretionary flaws of the court in this matter basically warrant a remand back to the court for.
So I think that would be your argument number three, or the third prong. What is it that you assert the district court did wrong in deciding the case? Assuming we're past it, I should have decided it, whether it should have been reconsidered or vacated.
Right. Again, the original judgment and decree terms were joint legal, joint physical custody, mom having primary residence. The court's order changed that. Under the statute, and under Crowley v. Meyer, which I'm basing my primary argument on this morning, it's basically a requirement that the court in such a case would have to have a finding of endangerment in order to change the custody, which, under a practical reading of this, you've changed the schooling of the children, you've moved them dozens of miles away from mom to a different school district. Not only that, but you basically gutted her parenting time down by at least 50% by virtue of the order change.
So an endangerment finding is required to change custody. Is it required to change principal residence?
Principal residence includes such things as changing the schooling of the children and
so the only reason I ask that because I'm just trying to figure out the analysis. Does it matter whether we call this a change of custody or a change of primary residence if in either case the district court is required to make an initial finding of endangerment and then have an evidentiary hearing? Does the judge have to do that if he's just calling it a change of primary residence?
We would argue yes, but in fact, there's case law that suggests, I believe it's Ayers, that basically suggests that the change of the primary residence in and of itself does constitute a change of custody. And especially when it's attended by circumstances such as changing the schooling and substantially changing the parenting time of the other party. A quote from Crowley basically indicates, if the party establishes a prima facie case, and by the way, again, there is no finding of endangerment here. There's only a prima facie case of change of circumstances in this case, which is a lesser standard, which should not have been applied in this case. It should have been the endangerment portion of the statute. But even if you assume that the prima facie case is made for change of circumstances, the district court must hold an evidentiary hearing at which evidence may be presented on each factor. And that would include, I believe, a recitation of the best interest statute as well in the context of that hearing. But more importantly, the endangerment portion, which the declaration affidavit of the respondent in this case did not assert facts that support in a finding of endangerment.
And practically speaking, yeah. When someone goes to the district court and wants to change custody or change primary residence, there needs to be an initial showing which determines whether or not there will be an evidentiary hearing. Is that accurate?
Correct.
So practically speaking, when you show up for that first hearing, people aren't expecting to do an evidentiary hearing because you don't know that there's going to be an evidentiary hearing. In other words, when you go to the first hearing, the judge makes a decision whether or not there will be an evidentiary hearing, that people get their ducks in a row, their witnesses, their evidence, and they come back on a later day. So would it be unreasonable, what you would say it was, to have expected mother to be there to be ready to participate in an evidentiary hearing that day? She should have just been there to litigate this preliminary finding of whether or not a hearing was necessary.
Well, again, I'm attributing to a pro se client at the time what she should or should not have known. My perception would be, though, if it certainly it was me preparing, I'd be preparing to hear the prima facie evidence on the other side, preparing for whatever argument I might use to say that the prima facie case was not met.
But I guess my point is, at that first hearing, the issue really is, has a showing been made to justify an evidentiary hearing?
Right.
And just in terms of district court calendars and lawyers' calendars, it's not realistic to have people preparing for a full-blown evidentiary hearing that won't happen if there's no prima facie showing of endangerment. That's so correct. Missing that first hearing perhaps should not have been the end of the case.
That is correct. And that's our argument today. I want to go back to the third issue.
Before you move on, I'd like to know whether or not you would agree that we're able to determine that the district court made an implicit finding of endangerment here.
I don't believe there's any indication of implicit endangerment. My reading of that order several times is there was no finding by the court of any coming anywhere close to the endangerment standard.
But it did find that the requirements were met to issue the order to change the primary residence and to change the schools. And so therefore, it implicitly found that in fact endangerment existed based on the information in the affidavit.
We believe the order was based on an incorrect determination that the change of circumstances standard would carry the day and bring the matter to a conclusion as far as custody is concerned. That is not the correct standard in this matter. The correct standard in this matter is the endangerment standard, and you don't change custody of two children without implicitly finding endangerment, not just change of circumstances, which the court actually expressly found.
So am I mistaken in my understanding that in fact mom and dad both still share physical and legal custody of the children?
That's my understanding. They share that by title, yes.
Okay. And it is the primary residence that was changed.
And therein lies the question as to whether a change of primary residence basically serves as a change of custody in the eyes of the court, and we believe it should.
I see that your time is up. I'd like to kind of one question for you. Yeah. On rebuttal. I'm wondering what authority you would rely on for your proposition that the notice language in that notice of the hearing from Minnesota Rule of General Practice 30301C informing the non-moving party that they had to inform the court that they in fact opposed the motion. To what extent does the lack of that language in that notice cause an issue for us that we should remand this for further hearings? You don't have to answer now, but you can answer on rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
We will now hear from counsel for respondent. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jan Jude. I'm here on behalf of Justin Schroeder, the respondent in this matter. And I will likely be fairly brief unless the court has a lot of questions, but we are here today primarily because of the appellant's refusal to participate in what the court initial judgment and decree ordered. Was that the parties attempt to mediate any parenting time issues that were occurring, and she refused to do that after several attempts to get her to do that. There are some other things in the judgment and decree that she was also not following, but I would like to address the primary residence issue. While we, in language, asked for a change in primary residence, and that's what the court put in its order as well, there are arguments here to say that really primary residence wasn't actually changed in reality. The judgment and decree said that the appellant would be awarded primary residence if the parties could not agree on a parenting time schedule. And if they could not agree on a parenting time schedule, then she would be awarded primary residence and they would be restricted to the schedule that was set forth in the judgment and decree. That's not what happened here. The parties did agree to a separate parenting time schedule that was different than what was set forth in the decree. In addition, with regard to primary residence, the definition of that says that the place where a party has established a permanent home for which the party has no present intention of moving. In this situation, part of the issue and part of the concerns that were raised is that the appellant was continuing to move the children around. There are at least 7 moves documented.
Counsel, can I stop? Because I think what I'd really like to hear you focus on are the procedural issues that are being raised. We have. Do you agree that Mother appeared for her Zoom hearing at around 10:30 thereabouts?
That is my understanding.
Okay. And contacted the court through a lawyer within 24 hours, saying she misunderstood this handwritten date, wanted to have an opportunity to be heard by the court. Court said no.
That's my understanding. I don't have direct knowledge of that, but that's what we have.
If those are the facts, I don't want to speak for the panel, but am I wrong to be concerned that perhaps the court rushed to judgment and should have allowed Mother an opportunity to give her side of what happened instead of deciding an issue about moving the children from one home to another based on an affidavit? Because it's my understanding, did your client provide sworn testimony at the hearing?
No, there's no sworn testimony.
Was he subject to any questioning from the court?
No.
No, but with just his affidavit.
That's correct.
For the decision.
That's correct.
And we've got a custody decision based solely on an affidavit because Mother appeared for a hearing 15 minutes later than the appointed time, and there's a handwritten date telling her what time to appear.
Typically, in these initial family law motions, that's all that the court considers is affidavits and some brief arguments.
But initially, the district court would consider the affidavit and say, is there enough here to have a hearing?
Enough to make a prima facie finding.
Yes.
And then have an evidentiary hearing.
And do you agree that in practice that evidentiary hearing occurs at a later time? In other words, people don't come to court prepared to have a full-blown evidentiary hearing when the judge first has to make a prima facie determination to determine whether or not there should be such a hearing.
That's correct.
So if in this case, the affidavit was sufficient to allow the district court to make the necessary prima facie determination, why did we not then have a separate evidentiary hearing where mother could present her version of what's been going on?
I don't know that. I know counsel has indicated that a specific denial for a request for an evidentiary hearing was given. I don't necessarily agree with that. I don't know that there was a clear request to have this set on for an evidentiary hearing and a clear denial to have an evidentiary hearing. I don't even necessarily contest the fact that if this court were to send it back for an evidentiary hearing, I don't necessarily object to that. The only thing I would say is that this was default. And so it's unclear, I guess, whether or not the court has authority under Rule 303.03b that when a party fails to provide responsive documents, he didn't even have to hold that preliminary hearing.
Well, can we address that then?
Absolutely.
Because that's exactly the question that I asked your opposing counsel. And I would like to know what you're relying on for your proposition that the notice language was in fact not required. It says it's mandatory by my reading of the statute. So explain to me why that doesn't carry the day here.
Correct. I could not find any case law saying that that was a fatal defect.
I understand. So what the rule says is you have to have this notice saying if you don't appear and defend, you might lose. That notice wasn't there. You're saying it doesn't matter, that the notice was fine. Yet at the same time, you're saying, well, you know, if it goes back, she doesn't get to defend because she didn't present her documents. Well, how do we fault her for not presenting her documents when the notice mandating her to do that wasn't in the notice? It doesn't seem that you can have it both ways.
Right. And I searched for case law looking for, is that a fatal defect? And I could not find anything. I did find several case law citations that I included in my brief that set forth when there are irregularities or defects or things omitted, that it isn't fatal to the situation. Had she obtained counsel, like she told me she had obtained counsel would have known that. Of course, she's a pro se litigant and she wouldn't apparently have known that, but there isn't that much difference in the law. I also cited stuff about pro se litigants, what she should have known and what she should have done.
But we're talking about a situation where the pro se litigant was supposed to be told, here's what you need to do at this hearing. And you're saying, well, she didn't do that, therefore there should be a consequence. So I have a hard time, you know, I hear what you're saying. There's no case law saying strict compliance or this doesn't seem that difficult. It's due process, a reasonable notice, an opportunity to be heard. I think one could argue reasonably that reasonable notice would include any mandatory requirements of failure to comply with would get you tossed out of court.
And there was no indication to us that she intended to participate in this anyway. She indicated to my client that day that she wasn't planning on attending anyway. I mean, she had actual notice of this. She didn't comply with the mediation requirement. I mean,
let's stick with what's in the record and the procedural issues.
And those are in the record, actually.
But. And if we were to decide that, in fact, this was essential information that needed to be in there to the point that it is fatal, is that something that you think there should be case law on? In other words, if that were something we were to determine was necessary here, is that something you would think there should be a presidential opinion issued on?
I guess my short answer to that would be no. She had knowledge of what the issues were. She had knowledge of the motion. And again, I'm not saying that she shouldn't have an evidentiary hearing on this matter so that she can present her side. That was the trial court's decision to shut it down.
I appreciate you being forthright about that. Thank you.
Council, would you agree that during the COVID times, especially in all these Zoom hearings, that generally speaking, parties would give them a lot more leeway when they didn't meet the requirement like being on time over a dispute as to whether the time is stated properly? I mean, I came back and did some retired bedroom and thought, what he's going to do, making all kinds of accommodations that we might not have made.
I would agree with that. Yes, COVID definitely changed a lot of things with the procedures in the court. I would agree.
You can proceed.
Okay, I just wanted to point out a few things with endangerment. I do believe that the court's order did in fact address endangerment. There were several citations with regard to what constituted endangerment in addition to the things that constituted the change of circumstances. And I would also point out that the affidavit was very detailed and it had several exhibits attached to it that supported the endangerment. So I just wanted to point that out for the court as well. And I don't have anything further.
The judge didn't really go there. He wanted to change the circumstances.
I believe there were some specific findings about the OnlyFans participation and the lewd videos that were on one of the children's iPads, the several moves. I think there was it addressed the failure to provide the children with prescriptions after they were diagnosed with pneumonia. I think he did list several of those items in there.
Is this OnlyFans one of those sites that people called influencers use to try to make money?
I know it's used to make money. I know it involves a lot of body part type things. Other than that, I don't know a lot of details other than it was causing some dangerous situations for the children. Clients of hers were following them in stores. She was broke into twice while the children were present. And that also was another factor the court addressed, that she had been leaving the children, which they were under the age of 7 at that time, home alone after these break-ins had occurred, which was causing fear to the children.
Has there been visitation? What's the current parenting time on it?
I believe she is utilizing an every other weekend parenting time schedule right now.
Did the parents work that out among themselves, or is that what was in place prior to the children moving to their father's home?
What we had asked the court to do was essentially flip the schedule. So my client had been having every weekend, sometimes Friday to Sunday, sometimes Friday to Monday, sometimes Friday to Tuesday. It was almost nearly a 50% parenting time. And we were asking for that to be flipped so long as she could show that she was providing a safe environment for the children.
So mothers in contact with regular contact,
yes,
with the children, unsupervised.
Yes. Yeah, correct. Yes. Any other questions? Okay, I don't have anything further.
I don't think so. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Rebuttal?
The court had a specific question in regard to the notice requirement in the motion papers as to time for response, whether it's in paperwork form or by other means. The rule is very clear. It's 303.01c. There's no leeway given on this in terms of the motion that is before the court in this matter. There's no exemption that allows it to be removed regardless of facts that might be asserted. To say that she wasn't cooperative certainly is not a basis to say we don't have to provide the notice mandated by the court rules. The one thing I have in common with counsel on this is we tried to do a search as to whether or not this particular portion of the general rules spawned any case law which speaks directly to the issue of forfeiture or other denial of motion expressly on the failure to show this information. But we do take great exception to the idea that, well, mom didn't provide anything to the court at the time for the time of the hearing, so therefore she should be punished, when we didn't put a mandated notice in the motion papers that would have allowed her at least notice to know that she should do something 7 days prior to the hearing. It could have been a tip off to her, hey, I've got to have an attorney because
I need to prepare for this hearing. It's not just a he said, she said thing. It's now a I'm going to lose my kids thing. And so, but in answer to your question, is there something else that supports me on this proposal that this should be fatal to the motion? No, there's no case law that supports that, that I'm aware of at this time. I do want to note a factual problem here. Yes, I think counsel properly stated what the parenting time arrangement was prior to this order issuing. A reading of the order shows it wasn't a flipping that took place here in terms of equal arrangement. Mom now is limited to alternating weekends, not every weekend like dad was seeing so much of the time, limited to Fridays through Sundays. So this is at least a cutting in half of the parenting time that dad had been operating under prior to this change of primary residence. And that's why we think the change of primary residence is really a change of custody in this matter, because you have pretty much gutted her parenting time in this matter. And I also want to speak to the idea of finding of endangerment by the court. There is no finding of endangerment. If you read the order, there's no finding of endangerment. He recites the allegations of dad, but he doesn't make an actual finding that any of those allegations raise to the level of endangerment. Instead, on page 3 of the order, paragraph 6, he basically indicates that, I'm sorry, that's the wrong page. Paragraph 6 on page 2, the court only found that there had been a significant change of circumstances based on the submissions and arguments of modification of the children's primary residence as being in the best interest of the children. That is not the proper standard. The proper standard is endangerment, because these parties had no agreement at the time of their divorce that they would allow for the lesser standard to be applied in the case of changing custody. So we do believe the facts support an indication that this was a change of custody, which would have automatically required the endangerment portion of the statute to come into play. The court did not find endangerment. We do agree with counsel on one other thing. An evidentiary hearing is appropriate. That's all we ask for. To say that we did not request that, we would call the court's attention to the two letters of Mr. Dietrich that were sent directly to the court that counsel actually responded to at the time, indicating at the very least we have to have an evidentiary hearing on this, because my client's entitled to have the factors reviewed and testimony taken and the other appropriate steps that are necessary to a proper evidentiary hearing. So I'm not sure if you have further for me this morning.
If we were to determine that the notice was in fact defective and that we needed to reverse, would we also be remanding then? And would it be for the prima facie determination, or would it also be, or would it just be for the evidentiary hearing?
Our position would be, if you take the case, you reverse it and remand it back to the district court. The district court is then in a position to start fresh in terms of the need for the establishment of the prima facie case, because she was denied the opportunity to appear and make whatever rebuttal. And I've been in these cases where prima facie is the issue. I've never won one yet, because it's the presumption is the affidavit is correct and factually accurate on its stand. So we believe now she was denied that opportunity to at least voice an objection to some of the findings. And we believe they should start the case over. The children should go back to mom. The parenting time schedule resume the way it was. He can bring his new motion. And the court should proceed most likely to an evidentiary hearing.
How long have they been in the grad school?
Oh, the new school, that was from, I believe, January of this year. And again, that's about, I believe it's 70 miles or so distance apart between the parties now. So it does impact, you know, regular seeing of the children. But I mean, I am concerned that the court went the extra mile to reduce our client's parenting time so substantially when, as counsel's indicated, that wasn't even the request. The request was to keep the primary on a basic equal time frame as far as weekends and so forth. So I don't understand why the court went beyond what counsel was asking for in the default setting. And I do believe that to be punitive and shows a discretionary issue, which I think warrants the remand.
Thank you to counsel for your arguments and your briefing. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.